the reader will go inside the prison cells with him and live the same kind of life with through his eyes and know what it was actually like to be separated from his family and his friends in South Africa at the time. If you were a political prisoner and you were sentenced to life, unlike common criminals, life meant life. You were expected to die in prison. But despite that, he reveals to us the power of hope.
Sam Venter, a journalist who covered Nelson Mandela and the anti-apartheid struggle in their native South Africa during the turbulent decades of his imprisonment, and now works as senior researcher for the foundation that bears his name. I'm Matt Wells, and for this edition of our UN and Africa podcast from UN News, I'll be talking to her about what this new book reveals about the man who laid bare the injustices of the racial supremacy-based doctrine of the old South Africa before he led its non-violent transition to a new democratic era, beginning with his release from jail in 1990 after 27 years. Accompanying Sam on her visit here was one of Nelson Mandela's granddaughters, Zamaswazi or Swati Dlamini Mandela. In her moving forward to the volume of letters, she writes that it was the children who suffered the most and ultimately the consequences of forfeiting a stable family life for his ideals was a sacrifice that my grandfather just had to make peace with. She talked to a large and appreciative crowd at the UN bookshop and revealed what had moved her most about the letters and how her grandmother, Winnie Mandela, had also borne the brunt of his incarceration.
I certainly was drawn to the more positive letters where he speaks about hope and the power of positive thinking and your attitude towards your situation, because I think that's how he was able to endure it and that's how he was able to live through it and go through it, as well as trying to encourage my grandmother on the outside, who was the one who was constantly under attack and harassment, and she was fighting for her life every single day. You know, as much as he was under a very brutal system, she had to fend for two small children. And I'm not excluding my aunts and my uncles because they suffered too. So all of them, all his children, I find it incredible that he was still able to be so positive despite it all. So for me, I took that and I received it. A lot of them were too difficult for me to consume.
And in our interview for this podcast, Sam Venter also outlines what she thinks the creation of an official Nelson Mandela Day by the UN General Assembly in 2009 meant to the man himself.
Well, it takes away the notion that we could not be like Mandela because he was so great. He wanted us to know that all of us could be like him if we just did little things in our lives to make things better for other people.
How did this extraordinary volume of letters come about? Because half of these letters have been in the public domain already, haven't they? What for you are the key insights that these extra letters give the world?
Well, when we say half have been in the public domain, some of them just in quotations sometimes, or extracts, so not even as whole letters, all of them. So I think the key insights are to remind ourselves of Madiba's sacrifices, his vision, and his commitment to human rights and freedom and democracy. I think in the world today, we are losing that on so many levels. And people can go back to these exact words by this man written in prison to be inspired to continue the fight for freedom and justice.
It seems you can follow the evolution, not just of Mandela, the man who went on to be this obviously huge global civil rights icon, but also Mandela, the father, Mandela, the husband. It's an extraordinary blend of the personal, political and global in a way, isn't it?
Yeah, well, what I tried to do was to tell the story of his imprisonment through these letters. So obviously we had to do that. Focus on the father, focus on the husband, focus on the lawyer and the political leader who was liaising with the government in many instances, because he couldn't write to other people. He could only write to close family initially, and only later friends, and the only officials he could write to were prison officials to complain about something.
What to you were the sort of crucial points of this, of his story that these letters really helped to make three-dimensional? In a sense, it seems what you're saying is that we really just had fragments before, but this puts it all together.
I think the reader will go inside the prison cells with him and live the same kind of life through his eyes, and know what it was actually like to be separated from his family and his friends. And in some cases, there are letters about where he talks about going to the theatre, singing and dancing, and doing all kinds of, having a culturally rich life. And you don't think about that part of it. When they took away his freedom, they took away the colour out of his life also, the ability to go to the theatre, to dance, to enjoy good meals with friends, and to just have hope for the future.
Yeah, it seems also, of course, that what these letters also lay bare, you know, is the huge sacrifice that was made by his family, obviously above all his wife Winnie, but also the children and the grandchildren.
Absolutely, and I think Swati, who wrote the foreword to this book, who is with us here today, says that her aunts and her mother are still scarred today. They were small children when he went to prison. And the rules were that you could visit as a baby, not contact visits. You could visit up until you were 2, and thereafter when you were 16.
It's unbelievable cruelty, isn't it?
Yeah. And you know, it makes us think about the families today, especially at the Mexican border and places like that, who are separated, and what incredible torture this is. This sort of state-sponsored torture to separate families from each other. And you're not only punishing the person at the time, you're punishing them for decades to come through their family.
Well, you know, being a political prisoner anywhere is a special kind of hell, it seems. Mm-hmm. And if even one of the most resilient men in the world, Mandela, has, you know, huge troughs of despair, I mean, think of all the others that don't have his strength, I guess.
Absolutely. And he is painting this tragedy for us, that people who are in prison today around the world are experiencing this, and as you say, probably not handling it as well as he did. It really is, it's a devastating experience.
His granddaughter, who wrote the foreword for the book here, who's with you today, I mean, she said just now at the UN bookshop event that even she can't really read some of these letters. I mean, it's clear that pain is obviously still there, even several generations removed.
Absolutely. And, you know, she's a mother herself, and she reads a letter, for example, one he wrote to her mother in 1969, and her mother was 10 years old. Her father was in prison for life. The mother was also in detention, writing to her to say, we can't be there for you. You can't have us. You can't have your mum anymore. We don't know when she's coming back. We don't know when I'm coming back. And she tears up every time she reads this letter, because this is her family. We need to stick to these values, all of us, as citizens of the world, and hold fast to them and make sure that we treat all human beings with dignity and respect and allow everybody to live in freedom and democracy.
Is there anything in these letters that points the way to the international community at certain points letting him down during the course of his incarceration? I mean, are there ways in which the international community could have done more in order to end apartheid earlier?
He didn't have time for regrets, and he didn't like to criticize people very much. There are two letters that start this book. One is to Amnesty in 1962, the day before he was going to be convicted.
Amnesty International.
It wasn't called international then, but it was to Amnesty, saying, thank you for sending an observer to my trial. The next day, he was sentenced to 5 years in prison. And there's a letter to the Dutch ambassador saying, thank you for coming to my trial. Madiba was all about gratitude. And maybe the international community could have done more, probably could, the West especially, but he wasn't about to admonish anybody for anything. What happened was what happened. And he did what he could in his lifetime to make things better for other people. And he wasn't going to turn around and say to anybody, you know, point fingers and say, you didn't do this right or that right, no.
So what's most affected you personally, having edited these letters and brought them together?
It's a very interesting question because, you know, as you know, this kind of process is very labor intensive. But now I look back at the whole thing And I think that, you know, knowing quite a lot about him and having covered him as a journalist and met him and whatever, I think that this is the collection that he would have wanted. He would have wanted all of these aspects of his imprisonment to be out there for people to see. And maybe in a way he was, you know, guiding me in it. I don't know. But it was incredibly easy for me to choose which letters to put in. And I think it's because I have a very strong grounding in who he was as a person. So I'm very happy that for him, he can live on for future generations in this way.
Was there a letter that particularly surprised you, that shocked you even, gave you a fresh insight that you hadn't had before on Mandela?
I think there was one. I wasn't shocked or surprised, you know, moved maybe in various ways. There was a letter. You see, this whole process was almost like a detective process because we had to find out who he was talking about, what was happening. There was one letter written to somebody using two names which were clearly fictitious. It was Kwanini Mia, and both of those names, I was told, were clan names. We didn't know who they were, who this person was. And I went to Winnie Mandela. She helped a lot with this book. And she said, oh, that's easy. That's Duma Nokwe, who was a brilliant young lawyer in South Africa who was then in exile in Zambia. And through that information, I was able to contact his daughters, who were then able to tell me that I'm thinking, why is he writing to this man and talking about singing and dancing? You know, is it a code? I mean, what could it possibly be? And they said, no, my father loved singing and dancing. And so he remembered all of this about him and this. And it made me realize that, you know, as I said before, something extra that he had lost, this life that we all take for granted, not just the loss of his liberty in the sense of being locked up, but he lost that life, that getting up and going out and doing things and having vibrancy.
And yet he could recall those good times and the emotions, and that presumably sustained him to some extent.
Absolutely. And his memory was phenomenal. There was one letter he wrote, I think, to Kaiser Matanzima's wife, one of his wives, where he said, I don't know the date, but he said, dear so-and-so, do you remember what you were doing on, say, for example, the 14th of July, 1955, for example? And then he writes, don't answer immediately. Put the letter down, go away, think about it and come back to the letter. And it's almost sort of cinematographic. He says, okay, now you're back. I'll tell you what you were doing. I was in the trance guy and my car broke down. And you and your husband drove past. And you picked me up and gave me a lift. So you can imagine being in prison and these things going over and over in your mind. You can remember all these details about this life that you don't know if you're ever going to get back again.
But ultimately, he seems to have always believed that he would see the light at the end of this 27-year tunnel.
I think so, and I think that they did not give up hope. In South Africa at the time, if you were a political prisoner and you were sentenced to life, unlike common criminals, life meant life. You were expected to die in prison. But despite that, he reveals to us the power of hope, that you keep on hoping against even these odds, and in the end you could triumph, which is what he did.
We celebrated his centenary here at the UN this week. I mean, do you feel that he is still alive enough here at the UN? It is the kind of global crossroads for diplomacy, that his memory is going to be cherished in all the years ahead.
I think so, and with the people that you have at the helm in the UN today, and with South Africa on the Security Council, and the fact that the United Nations adopted Nelson Mandela Day in 2009, which is remarkable, and while he was still alive.
So that's more than just of symbolic value, you think, having a UN Day?
No, absolutely, and because of what it means. It means what he wanted it to mean. We have got to live lives of service. And it takes away the Mandela who felt, well, it takes away the notion that we could not be like Mandela because he was so great. He wanted us to know that all of us could be like him if we just did little things in our lives to make things better for other people. And the United Nations having this day and reiterating every year helps that process enormously.
Thanks very much indeed.
Thank you.
That was Sam Venter, their senior researcher with the Nelson Mandela Foundation, based in South Africa, who edited the newly published Prison Letters of Nelson Mandela. Well, that's it for this edition of our UN and Africa podcast, and we'll return soon with more in-depth analysis and engaging stories for you. Thanks for listening. I'm Matt Wells, here at UN headquarters in New York. Fátima que tô tão zara, diz que na que tô tão zara, aí tá timbiando que tô tão zara.